Have you seen Chuck Norris lately? He's still kicking butt and staying active well into his 80s. What's even more shocking is he looks more jacked than ever and seems to have more energy than guys half his age. And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of five-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
How do people feel about getting Big Fitness Energy at Planet Fitness for $15 a month? They feel as thrilled as a kid the first summer they're tall enough to ride the roller coaster. That's right. When you join Planet Fitness right now, you get access to tons of equipment and free fitness training in a clean and spacious club. Don't wait. Join the judgment-free zone today for that all-day energy. Download the free Planet Fitness app and join today for $15 a month.
Hurry. Deal ends September 12th. Join today for $15 a month.
See Home Club for details.
I'm Dan.
And I'm Alex. And welcome back to On Air. It's Wednesday, the 7th of August. I'm Alex. That's Dan. It's so good to be back with you guys. How are you, Dan?
We're back again. I feel like I fell back out of a coconut tree. I'm ready for a new week.
For anyone that doesn't follow US politics, you're going to sound like a psychopath.
No, I exist in the context. That's why I can say this stuff.
But you will never be unburdened by what has been. That is the crucial takeaway there. But seriously, how are things since we last spoke?
It's good, but I missed the podcast last week. I was like, it felt so empty. And then I was thinking, when did we last record? Oh my God, it's been so long. So yeah, I've missed you and I missed all the listeners. This is just an important part of my week these days.
Yeah, it's so true. I was really excited to record today. And of course, we've waited to record the same day that we published to ensure that we're super current on a couple of our hot topics that are coming up. We've got plenty to discuss. But you're right. And we've had a lot of messages as well from listeners who have had the time to think about longer form questions. But also, I don't know about you, my DMs and emails are absolutely full from listeners who are in touch with different travel dilemmas because, of course, it is summer and so many people are traveling. So perhaps if they weren't traveling in May or June and they are now, they are, encountering the weird and sometimes wonderful scenarios that aviation presents itself onto passengers. But also, you know, there's a lot of people that have been impacted by disruption that has been just about everywhere. We've had European air traffic delays. You've got crazy weather on the East Coast in the US, right? I mean, I keep seeing what's going on there with New York and Washington being out of action pretty much for the last week.
Yeah, well, I'm glad that's what's filling your inbox because mine is being filled with things like, "Hello, dear YouTuber. I hope this message finds you in good spirits. I'm writing on behalf of American big famous company Nike. We would like to sponsor one video on your..."
Wait, why would you not want Nike to sponsor you?
And then the email address is... So this is literally one I just got. Christopher.Bacara1y@op.pl.
That is a Polish scammer.
Yeah,
right. Exactly. That's so in Poland.
I'm glad your inbox is filled with the legit things, but I get quite a lot of these every day, so that kind of drowns out the good stuff.
Yeah, it's funny. And of course, because we're in this period now where, again, a lot of people that maybe wouldn't travel in other parts of the year are traveling now, do you find yourself also having to help out relatives or friends that get in touch? And I've had a lot of that over the last few weeks. I've had aunties that are, you know, stuck in queues, and one of them was flying British Airways back from Ibiza. She said to me, "Alex," she said, we're all at a departure gate. There is not a single member of staff here, and our flight has disappeared off of the departure boards. There is now no gate, No evidence of the flight even taking place this afternoon. The app hasn't updated. The website shows nothing. There's no staff. We can't call the airline. What is happening? And then I had kind of that repeated four different times over with the same airline, but a different European, different European hubs. It's, so I'm kind of on my phone like, hey, auntie, here's the deal. Here's what you need to do.
I mean, certain airports have been especially chaotic. Like Frankfurt Airport in the 2 weeks since we last recorded has had multiple instances of environmental activists blocking runways, tech issues, making the airport melt down. So a lot of problems there. Surprisingly, all my travels and all my family's travels, which is, there's been a lot in the past weeks, everything has been good. In fact, every flight has been early. So we feel very lucky.
Whenever I see an early flight, because it's, I mean, you know how you and I spend a lot of time on Flight Radar, right? And so I'm always just, whenever I have a spare moment, opening it up, seeing what's about. And also, crucially, in this period, just checking, you know, how late each aircraft is to major hubs. And if they're on time, I'm pleasantly surprised. But very rarely, if I was to find one that actually, for example, was supposed to depart at 13:30, 1:30 p.m., and it shows me that it actually got airborne at 1:23, I'm thinking, wow, that's super unusual. I don't know about you, but immediately I think of you and Etihad, that thing that happened years ago where didn't they just leave without you because they decided it was better to go early?
How do you remember that? I think that was like 2017 or something.
Every time I see any evidence of any aircraft, anyway, the last time I saw this was on Flight Radar. It was a few days ago. I saw a Porter Airlines in Canada, the little Dash aircraft. I saw one of them depart about 15 minutes early and I was thinking, my God. And straight away that story comes up, Dan Etihad, where you arrived to the gate, if I remember correctly, and the plane was gone because they decided it was better to leave without you.
So I think I made the flight. Honestly, I'm amazed. I think you remember this better than me, but I haven't missed an Etihad flight, but there was something. I think I was flying from Beirut to Abu Dhabi. And like I showed up for my connection and it was like, oh, by the way, the flight is leaving like 40 or 30 minutes before schedule. And I'm just like, if that was me in a normal situation where I show up to the airport 61 minutes before departure, I would have been screwed. So.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, it's funny.
I think in those situations that you're talking about, usually it points to an empty flight and they just finished boarding earlier. Or like my family, bless them, have all been flying Ryanair because we all went to Scotland and Ryanair flies direct from Gothenburg to Edinburgh. And those flights, Ryanair, I can understand if they leave early because everyone is standing waiting to board in some holding pen 30 minutes before departure. So that's how, you know, they make that happen.
And of course, it wouldn't be, you know, maybe, you know, it was a week with no podcast last week. Of course, we didn't have the episode, but it wouldn't be a week without Gothenburg somehow showing itself or presenting it, you know, just appearing in front of me in my life that I'm trying to, you know, get on with. And you know this because I sent you the screenshot. So I won't tell you what I ordered because it is a gift. I mean, it's not a gift for you, but it's a gift. Oh. And I received notification from DHL like, hey, your package is here, it's ready to, you know, get going and it will be with you in a couple of days. And I click the tracking, bam, in front of me a full address of this warehouse outside of Gothenburg airport, and it's like sending from origin Gothenburg. I was like, what? I assumed it was coming from the UK. I mean, of all places, I didn't even think it was coming from the continent or in Europe, and it's coming from Gothenburg. And then of course, Dan, in the digital age that we live in the age of now and everything being lovely and instant, I can get what I want when I want, either same day or next day with Prime and all sorts of, you know, super fast delivery services. Of course, the one thing that I have ordered that is coming from Gothenburg, I ordered it 11 days ago and it has still not showed up. And every time I go into the tracking, it tells me estimated delivery is, and it just says like 5 days ago. And I'm thinking that cannot be a coincidence.
I think all those problems would be solved if you could just convince Qatar to relaunch flights to Gothenburg. everything, your delivery problem would be
delusional,
solved.
Delusional boy. Delusional boy. I need it delivered from just Europe to London. So I'm not naive in thinking that it's going to be next day to the Middle East, but to London, where I can order something right now and it will be shipped from Brussels and be here by the evening. But anyway.
So every night, I saw you ordered on DHL, every night at about 8:30 p.m., an A300 takes off from Gothenburg under DHL, headed for Copenhagen. And every day you hear it because it's so loud, the entire city of Gothenburg probably wakes up as it flies over.
Yeah, all 12 of you. Okay, go on.
And then, so it obviously could head to Copenhagen fast. I blame it on Denmark. Why is it not heading to the UK faster?
Shock. A Swede blames his problems on neighboring Denmark. I mean, we'll save that for another episode. Look, we have so much to get through, okay? And perhaps the hottest topic as we come to you now on this humble Wednesday morning is that Emirates, of course, one of what they regard themselves as one of the leaders in commercial aviation, have today has always been scheduled as the day that they will be revealing their, quote, new business class cabin. And Emirates have been describing this as a, quote, highly anticipated new business class seat for the Gulf carrier that operates to just about everywhere, not least to and from Dubai, but connecting the world via its Dubai hub. And we know in 2024, when an airline is introducing a new business class seat to the market, I mean, you're going to see something pretty phenomenal more often than not, because this is the era and the kind of the phase in aviation that we are in currently, where airlines have been outdoing each other, raising the benchmark, you know, and pushing further, elevating in terms of their product. So before we discuss it, I want to ask you, okay, Dan, you have an airline, right? And you're launching a, quote, highly anticipated new business class cabin in mid-2024. Give me a little rundown as to what the basics of that new seat would include.
Okay, obviously it includes doors in 2024. I think that's the big thing. It includes direct aisle access from every seat, of course, a lie-flat bed. It includes good storage, hopefully wireless headphone connections, USB-C charging, just improved tech like that. Then there are nice things to have, and I love that we saved this for this week and we didn't discuss it last time, but Q-Suite 2.0 is just such a hilarious contrast to this. Obviously at Farnborough Airshow, where you were, Alex, you can talk a bit more about what the reveal was like. Qatar Airways revealed the next version of their Q-Suite, and just something we've spoken about so much that I absolutely love that they did is they solved the problem of sitting in a window seat in business class in 2024 and always having to sit alone. You can't travel with a companion if you want to sit in a window, and they solved that problem by making a movable wall so you can sit and face each other, dine together, and have a window seat, which is just about the best thing I've ever seen.
And so you started off by explaining the fundamentals of what you would include in a new business class seat that is, quote, highly anticipated. And then you kind of link that just now with what we are seeing month after month, which is new cabin products being launched by different airlines, most recently by Qatar Airways, of course, with the Q-Suite Next Gen. So you're absolutely right. So that brings us then to this morning, okay? Emirates drop the first photos of their brand new business class cabin. Before I ask you what you thought initially, I had assumed they had uploaded the incorrect photo. I had initially assumed this is the same old cabin photo, so somebody in the team has had a little mistake there, because this is not the new cabin, surely.
Yeah, guys, this is going to lead to a really interesting discussion after we discuss what we think about the product itself and why Emirates might do something like this. But I think it's important to clarify here to what you're saying, that they never said it's a new business class product. They said it's a
new 777 business class product. No, they said it's a new business class cabin.
On the 777. No?
No, they described that it is, I'm going to bring it up so I can get it, so I can quote word for word. Because, of course, had they just said that this was a refit, there wouldn't be much to discuss here, right?
Yeah.
So, it says that the airline is carrying out its commitment to deliver an unmatchable onboard experience with the introduction of our latest 777 with new signature interiors, a latest business class cabin. A new business class cabin, highly anticipated, that it will offer customers a sense of exclusivity, privacy, complemented by blah, blah, blah. Then when they get the president of Emirates to speak about the product, he says, quote...
Yeah, this is a bit exaggerated.
A new business class cabin that raises the industry benchmark when it comes to premium travel. So, no... The exact terminology, phrasing, and context to all of this isn't, this is our 777 with different cabins, blah, blah, blah. They have, in their communications at least, clearly stated that this is a new business class cabin. Now, I've just noticed that the title on their PR thing has just changed, and I wonder if that's because of the slight bit of backlash that has already started to happen. But they have consistently referred to this as their latest business class cabin, highly anticipated new business class seat is one of the quotes as well. And of course, there was all the communication up to this point where they were teasing what was happening next about August this year and about how, oh, in August, we will reveal our new business class seat. There was also expectation that whatever is revealed today will be the seat that goes on the A350 and the upcoming aircraft that will follow the 350, the 777X.
Yeah, and there are indications that this will be that seat now because they've constantly talked about consistency. So as they were teasing this reveal, they basically said the new 777-300ER business class cabin will have 38 business class seats, which is 4 less than previously. So not a huge reduction considering it used to be in a 2-3-2 layout. The seat is produced by Safran, which made a lot of people think about their Unity seat. Could Emirates be choosing the Safran Unity, which is an incredibly popular state-of-the-art seat that a lot of airlines are going with. They say the seats will be fully flat, feature 44 inches of pitch, be 20.7 inches wide, and turn into a 78.6 inch bed. They'll have 23 inch screens, a personal mini bar, a large tray table, charging outlets, and ample storage. They will also put a small bar on the 777. Obviously not the same as they have on their A380, but I guess they're trying to streamline those experiences a bit more. So what they hinted at here, and I think what originally people were expecting was a brand new revolutionary product, but in what they're saying here, obviously if they were introducing doors, they would have told us about that because that's a huge development for an airline that has historically, or at least for the past 5 years or so, been kind of lagging behind when it comes to business class. So reading this was the original hint that we're probably not going to see something revolutionary, but what we've ended up with is literally almost the exact same product they have on their refurbished Airbus A380 business class. Mm.
So this is basically the same old existing seat, which again they were touting as a new business class product as recently as June, when they were highlighting how it will be flying by mid-August. They had hinted that their existing cabin, which was disliked in terms of having a middle seat, which is highly unusual in business class, and so on, and all the other details that you touched on, will be no more because Emirates is, quote, going to have a new business class seat on the Boeing 777s entering the market come the end of summer 2024. And it was generating headlines around the world about finally goodbye to that awful seat and hello to the new cabins that will debut on the 777. And here's what to expect and here's blah, blah, blah. So we've had all of this. And this morning, Emirates drop the images that show the same old seat. Right,
yeah.
It's the seat that's already flying on the A380, slightly modified. I mean, I'm just, if you zoom into the photos now, and for anyone that would like to see this new seat to understand clearly what we're speaking about, of course, this is now everywhere online, but also it's on our X Twitter profiles. if you check out, you can give me a retweet so that it appears on both. There we go. So you, if you check out the design of this seat, firstly, what is that minibar? It looks like it belongs in a shower. It looks like something that you purchase in Ansar Gallery, what's it, or Walmart or somewhere, and it's been plonked on to the same walnut dated design that you associate Emirates with in the 90s, okay? That's that. I can't believe they haven't used this as an opportunity to find a sleeker, more innovative way to include that. Then this armrest kind of area, I note that the width is greater than the seat itself, which also is just a bit bizarre. And look at the window seats, Dan. I mean, if you are in the window seats that are not directly next to the window, but that are next to the aisle, there's so much mess, cubicle mess next to you between the seat and the window. Why would they do this? What are they thinking?
Okay, I don't quite agree with how harsh your take is in terms of the seat being the worst thing ever. I've flown this seat many times on the A380. I think it's very comfortable. And we often talk about how there is something to be said for consistency. So as much as I'm super disappointed that we didn't get anything more innovative or at least the same seat with the door slapped on, it's quite nice to board an Emirates flight and know with quite a lot of certainty which type of seat you're going to get. And they're dedicating this aircraft to specific flight numbers. This is something that most other airlines in the world would never commit to. Emirates is saying,
and of course, airlines would never commit to that because they know operationally that's going to get very tricky, very difficult.
Yes.
Very tricky, very quickly, rather. Yeah, sorry.
What Emirates has done historically with their game changer first class is that maybe 6 days a week, they officially schedule it on Brussels and Geneva. And then there's some days where on the seat map, you see 8 seats and you know it's not the game changer. So then that gives them some leeway in case something happens, in case maintenance or whatever, they can pull it out and people won't be disappointed. So I like that they're doing this. I like that, you know, an Emirates customer will be able to experience the same thing on an A380 as a 777, but I would have liked to see something nicer, of course. I think that the really fascinating thing here is to look at the contrast between airlines in the Gulf and also what this tells us about Emirates, because comparing Emirates to, they most often get compared to Qatar Airways, who are their closest competitor, but in so many ways, the airlines could not be more different in how they operate, the business models in terms of sending massive aircraft to bigger cities. Emirates doesn't really serve any smaller markets, while Qatar Airways is focused on serving a bigger number of markets, but perhaps not with the same type of aircraft. Emirates has many, many daily frequencies to big cities all around the world. So also, you have to look at their hubs. You look at Dubai compared to Doha. And that made me draw the connection almost between Emirates and Singapore Airlines when I was thinking about some of these airlines that are world-leading and considered by many to be some of the most desirable airlines to fly. Singapore Airlines is the same. And they also, you know, objectively don't have the most impressive business class hard product.
But Singapore Airlines' business class is absolutely superior to what we have just had unveiled by Emirates. The difference is Emirates are unveiling it in mid-2024 as a brand new business class cabin. This is the part I don't understand. Had they have just said in all of the communication around this, oh, we're refitting our 777s with the cabin of the A380 in order to ensure consistency, I think that's a win. That is a complete easy win. Low-hanging fruit, you are going for consistency, and there would be no kind of weird articles that are starting to appear online now where people are saying, huh? How are you referring to this as a, quote, highly anticipated new business class cabin? This is the same as you have. This is the existing. I think that's the part. If Singapore Airlines did this and they had, you know, touted it in this way thus far and then dropped these photos this morning, you would have messaged me saying WTF.
I know, which we did. But think about it. Singapore Airlines has also made similar announcements, like hyping a huge improvement to their premium economy only to slightly improve the soft product. So,
yeah,
you know, I think it, like, I want to have this discussion with you because I think, why is it that certain airlines, because I do agree that Singapore Airlines has a slightly better seat, but there is so much more they could do. And many people really dislike Singapore Airlines seat because, first of all, it doesn't really recline. You have to flip it over to make a bed.
So but it really wasn't it wasn't launched in 2024. So that's a key difference.
Yeah, but they're still taking delivery of aircraft with that seat to this day.
Yeah.
A350s with that seat.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's still a modern product in their eyes. That it's just like, in if you think about a market like Dubai, I think I know so many people who live in Dubai who fly Emirates no matter what. They won't consider any other airline. I have one friend who keeps texting me twice a year around Christmas and summer when she's going on vacation. She goes, can you help me get Emirates business class? And I tell her continuously, she refuses to believe I don't have any inside contacts. I tell her, I don't have any strings I can pull, but I can try to get you a points redemption and you can sort of pay cash at a reduced price through my points. But then I find the points rate, which is extremely high, and I tell her, you could fly Qatar Airways or Gulf Air for a third of that price. I can help you get that. And they go, no way. I only fly Emirates. So that to me is one example of what a following an airline like Emirates or a Singapore Airlines has in their local markets, which are quite wealthy, obviously.
Yeah.
And then also, if you look at the prices that Emirates is charging for their tickets, they're consistently one of, if not the most expensive airline on any route they serve, whatever the cabin is. And that, personally, that doesn't make any sense to me. But it shows that Emirates is able to command a premium because of the brand they've built. So although, you know, they have this disappointing, quote unquote, new business class seat, but people are still going to pay a ton for it. So what
reason? But that's always the way. I mean, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Well, what reason do they have to innovate? Are we not looking? So let me answer that directly. Are we not looking at the likes of Emirates to be able to ensure that aviation continues to push and elevate and reach new heights in that nice competitive game that we assume Emirates is at the top of? You know, we assume that they are at the top of their game and they are always striving for more to raise that benchmark to ensure that the likes of the others who kind of catch up 5-6 years later, like British Airways and American and so on, so that they end up following. This is not an example of that. So I think I was so, the lack of inspiration here, this is so uninspiring. It's so nothing that I'm just surprised because we usually get the opposite from Emirates. You think of Emirates and you think of traditionally a world leader in aviation. This is not world leading. This says to me, I look at this and I wonder if they are referring to this as to what they are referring, what does that mean for the future products? What does that mean for their, as they take new, for example, 777X and so on? Yeah. And again, it is about the decision making behind this. Why would they have the Emirates president, Sir Tim Clark, say, quote, you know, this new business class cabin, was, I mean, rule number one, I would not refer to that as a new business class cabin because it's not. That's just point blank. That's just not true. But why would they have him say, this raises the industry benchmark when it comes to premium travel? Emirates has very often in history raised that industry benchmark. They have been so successful at competing and being the leaders and having that vicious fight at the top with other Gulf carriers and then with the rest of the world and Singapore and so on. I mean, do they simply just use these tag freight? Do they use these taglines now, regardless? Because the photos and the cabin that they have just revealed to the world does not match up to what they are, how they are describing it. And for me, I just find that, you know, that's a shame because Emirates usually is like, okay, if we're going to announce something, it's going to blow everything else out of the water and we are going to, you know, break the internet. That kind of attitude.
I agree with what you're saying that the dialogue is a bit wrong, but I want to ask you, do you think that it's dangerous to try to always stay at the front of the pack? Like, do you think that Qatar Airways, by constantly innovating, they're sort of creating more problems for themselves than they would have to?
I don't think so. I think that the natural progression of any airline at the top of their game would be to always ensure that they are innovating and so on and so on. And look at how in Qatar Airways they've had the new change of the CEO. And he said, Badr Almir, in his speech at the reveal at a Q-Suite Next Gen ceremony in Farnborough last week, a couple of weeks ago now, he said that he was really happy to be there unveiling a new product and kind of sad that nobody else has raised that benchmark. So it was up to QR to do it again. Obviously, you know, he's poking fun at the fact that he believes that they are still leading the industry when it comes to something like their business class product, which most people would argue that they are in terms of the product offering. It's still widely regarded as the world's best business class for a whole variety of different reasons. But I think that in order to have healthy competition, you need an Emirates that is at the top of their game and is matching that kind of energy. By the way, you know, that's energy that they've been matching over years and years and years. Is this a slowdown? Is this the beginning of them saying, you know what, we're kind of chill with what we've got and we're satisfied. We're not going to be innovating and you're not going to be seeing the amazing innovations that we were doing a decade ago with the likes of, you know, having the showers on board and the social area in terms of the bars and so on. So I, to answer your question, I think that it is important to continue to strive for more and continue to push. And we rely on the airlines that A, have the most money and B, have the most vision and inspiration and energy to get that done, to ultimately then shape the direction that the rest of the industry then follow. We rely on the Singapore Airlines of this world, on the Qatars, on the Emirates and so on to do that, because what we typically have seen over the last 20 years in aviation is what they decide to do and implement in terms of their cabin innovations, their onboard service design and so on, the rest eventually end up following. And that is just a God-given fact. I can remember when the world's first business class with the sliding doors and double beds in business class was introduced, which was the Q-Suite, all those years ago. I remember being with a British Airways team a few weeks after that launch, and the head of product or cabin design at that time said to me, well, yeah, our passengers tell us the doors are not for them. They actually enjoy the interaction with their fellow passengers and with the crew, and they don't want to be closed in with sliding doors, and it all makes it a bit claustrophobic. 7 years later, almost every British Airways long-haul jet now has sliding doors, and they realize that passengers want nothing more than privacy. So it's, yeah, you know, it's inevitable. They have to lead so that the others will follow. And this is an example, in my eyes, of Emirates not leading, unless they're going to shock us in a few months and we're going to have a brand new product elsewhere. But I think from the communication, it's quite clear that that's not going to be the case.
Yeah. I wonder if this is a sign of the Middle Eastern aviation market maturing, because it's still very new on a global scale. We're talking 20, 30 years of, you know, any type of significant operation in the region. So is this the first sign of an airline saying, sort of landing in, this is what we are, this is what we offer, and we are established. We don't need to keep chasing the front of the pack? Because the reason I asked you that question is that I think there is a danger in constantly trying to have the best, because as soon as someone, you know, Qatar Airways introduces the Q-Suite, about 2 years or a year and a half later, ANA introduced the Room, which arguably is an even better seat in itself. I still love in Q-Suite that you can get the quad, which I wish more airlines would innovate and or replicate. But it was very quick for an airline to say, we made an even wider and more spacious seat than you. So you can have the most innovative product, but I think that only lasts so long. And then you know,
but that's,
you have
great,
to go straight
the idea
back
is
in.
The idea is not to be alone at the top, though. So that's a good thing, because you've just said, Qatar, for example, had revealed that amazing, innovative Q-Suite back then. And then shortly after, ANA unveiled the Room. I see that as a great thing. So it's not just QR passengers that benefit from an unbelievable business class. You then have a whole load of passengers in Japan also benefiting.
Yeah, but if you also look at, you look at something like ANA, they have the room on part of their fleet, but most of their fleet is still Dreamliners with a similar seat to this new Emirates seat. And ANA is still taking delivery of Dreamliners with that seat. And again, going back to something like Singapore Airlines that is matured, or a Cathay Pacific, which, you know, also is taking delivery of quite a standard seat. I'm just trying to argue here that there's something to, I'm not saying I love this seat. Again, I'm not saying I'm excited about this development, but I think it is an interesting sign of a change at Emirates, a change perhaps coming up in the region as a whole for airlines.
Why is that representative of the wider region? Because they've chosen not to actually install a new business class cabin when they have said they're installing a new business class cabin.
Okay,
but it's true, isn't it? Why, if we're looking at the region, we've just spent 1 year talking about how Riyadh Air, you know, arguably the next most significant player in the region, are going to be coming online next year, supposedly next year, and wowing us with never been seen before innovations, digitalization, cabin products, and so on and so on. And you've been agreeing for a year that this is the direction that the likes of a new Saudi state-owned startup with a huge budget is going to take, you know, everything further, and we're going to be pushing and striving for more. And Emirates drop this depressing new cabin, new in inverted commas. And now you're telling me, yeah, I think this is where the region is now. No, I think it's time to close up the shop.
But isn't that interesting? Like, I'm glad you brought up Riyadh Air, because I will say we initially had huge expectations of what they were going to do. We were expecting an insane first class, a business class that would rival or surpass Q Suite. And I think what we're hearing now is it will be a fantastic seat with a even better soft product, but not something industry leading, not quite what we were expecting at the start, something that will make the whole world say, wow, it will be great, but not, you know, taking the level up a notch. So again,
I think Anton might have something to say about that. I mean, I'm still hoping he's going to be out of this world, because that's kind of what they were. Yeah, and also, you know, they've got a clever team there. Let's see what they're able to achieve. But I still think it's in the interest of the industry that it is. I mean, look at Qantas's new cabins, the ones that are going to be flying on the A350s. Again, you know, it's something that is clearly different to what the Gulf carriers, who often lead, would opt for. It's different to what Singapore would opt for. But it's very nice. It's a solid first-class product. It's a solid business-class product. And, I mean, it just makes it all the more worthwhile to book airlines that are actually going to be investing constantly in these new products. And also, by the way, another reason why I think it's important that airlines are continuing to put their hands in their pockets and reinvest in new products and innovations and so on, is that, as we have discussed, most airlines are making the most money they have ever made in the history of commercial aviation, right? Most airlines this year, there are so many airlines this year that have made the most money that they have ever made in the existence of their own carriers. And therefore, let them reinvest that into upping the game, you know, and into keeping things competitive in terms of their product, so that you can continue to be the YouTube sensation that you are.
Yeah, I wish for my YouTube sake they had introduced something more interesting. But again, did they have to spend that money on making an even better product? Because they're already charging so much. So what's the point? And then, you know, if they make an even better seat, are they going to be able to charge more? Probably not. So I think
that was part of the decision making? Like, do you actually think that was part of the decision making process?
I think they said, we're making record profits. Our flights are mostly full. People love flying with us on the A380. So there's no reason we have to go out here and make another revolutionary product. Another thing is,
then why refer to it as a
won't be reconfigured. So I think they don't want to make something that will be, first of all, I don't think they want to make something that will greatly overshadow the A380 business, because suddenly that makes the flagship Emirates experience look less desirable. I also think they want something that seems great, but not so good that someone who ends up in an old 232777 will ask for all their money back.
And so isn't that interesting? I mean, is there really a world where Emirates, who have led the industry for so many years, decided at the table, guys, let's go for great, but not so great?
Yeah, apparently yeah. this is the new
Well, I don't
Emirates.
Think this is great. This is just the same. This is not, nothing has been, I mean, this is just the same. This is a retrofit.
Yeah. I also think this reminds me a bit of Lufthansa, now that we're discussing this. It's an airline that, Lufthansa Allegris, I would say, seems to be similar quality to Emirates A380 business class seat or the new 777 business class seat.
Well, there's more privacy.
Yeah. In Allegris?
Yeah.
Depending on which seat you have, I guess, since they have like seven different
types. Okay, but they do, which is a mess, and we've spoken about that. Yeah. But often than not, it's going to be a more private experience than this.
Yeah. But this, Emirates is also an airline that has first class on almost all their aircraft. It's interesting it won't be on the A350. And I wonder if we could see this same seat with a door slapped on the A350, for example, because that would give this seat, you know, a longer life when you compare it to the 777s, which will be phased out maybe in the next 10, 15 years anyway. If the A350 is going to be around longer, they could give this seat, you know, a longer run by just slapping on a door.
I have tweeted images of these new quote new cabin, the quote highly anticipated cabin, the quote the new business class cabin that will quote raise the industry benchmark when it comes to premium travel, end quote. Okay, and so that it's fair, it's been on there for an hour, I'm going to quickly read you the most recent 10 or so comments. Okay, not filtering out, they're all there, visible to read. First one is just coming 3 minutes ago from Nick. He says, you know it's underwhelming when a BA club suite looks far more appealing. Second one is from Natasha. She says, to be honest, I somewhat expected more. The third one is from Jumana. She is a Bloomberg TV anchor based in Dubai. She says, groundbreaking. The next one is from Michael. He says, where's the door? Where's the Karma color scheme? Why do the middle passengers have to sit on top of each other? Next one is from Jack. He says, pretty lackluster. Next one is from Moise. He says, they look so underwhelming. Everyone was anticipating a closed suite door. Next one says, after Etihad's new suites, this is really surprising to me. Are they repurposing the A380 seats from aircraft they don't intend to ever reactivate or something else?
That's interesting. I don't think that's the case, but I lost my point. What I was going to say about the first class, comparing it to Lufthansa, is that an airline that has a first class is also usually very careful about cannibalizing demand for its first class product, which is why we generally see airlines, if you look at Cathay or you look at, well, ANA maybe went a bit too far with doing their room, which looks pretty much as good as their new first class on the 777s. But you look at Cathay, you look at Lufthansa, you look at even in Air France, which, yes, they introduced doors in their new business, but Air France, many airlines that have first class will make a business class that's intentionally a bit below the competition, so their first class will truly shine. I'm not saying this is a good thing, but that's just how it works to make people want to book up and want to book first class so that Emirates can continue filling first class on most of its flights, because that's truly what gives Emirates their first class, their halo effect. Again, it's not the most groundbreaking first class seat on 99% of their fleet, but people love it. I love it. I would gladly fly it over.
It's a great first class seat. They have a solid first class experience that, I mean, anyone who flies it, I think, instantly loves it. It's a great experience. That's true. And it's also a very valid point that they are one of the few airlines that has first class on almost every aircraft. You're right. Whereas the rest of the industry is kind of trending in the other direction.
Yeah.
And so maybe it's more important for them to maintain that gap. So maybe that's part of the decision making behind this. That's true. What do you think? I mean, how do you think this is going to be received by, for example, the YouTube sphere? Okay, so you are... I've just got an email from DHL. Your delivery is today.
Oh, finally.
Finally.
Your new host is arriving in 10 minutes.
Yep, I got a new one from Gothenburg, ladies and gents. I'm buying locally.
So I think YouTube is going to roast this. I will probably roast this just for views, but you podcast listeners know that we've had a more nuanced debate here. And I think ultimately for an airline like Emirates, it doesn't really matter what you know people are saying on blogs or on YouTube. British Airways was the butt of the industry jokes for years before they introduced Club Suites, and they were doing fantastic. So
yeah,
it's a shame for an airline like Emirates that really has relied on a lot of online hype, but they also have the game changer first class on these same aircraft where they have the new 777 first class. So they can just point to that and say, but hey, have you seen this? No one else has a first class seat on a non-A380 that's close to this.
And while we have mentioned it a few hundred times, I think we'll close up on the Emirates discussion by just saying that, again, had the airline had not decided to release communication to the world in anticipation of the seat, and then when the seat was revealed this morning, referring to it as, quote, highly anticipated, a new business class seat, a new business class cabin, something that raises the industry benchmark, a comment from the president, and so on, then we wouldn't have had even half of this discussion, because we would have said, oh, how great, in the interest of consistency, they're putting the A380 seat onto the 777, right? Yeah. Case closed. Good. Great for passengers seeking out consistency there, which is super important when you're spending hard-earned cash. But this is not what they have chosen to do. And I just think that's a really questionable decision there that maybe we will... I mean, I wonder if we'll see some adjustments as to how this is referred to going forward. Because don't forget, this is the initial release, right?
Yeah.
So I wonder what we'll see going forward. Maybe they'll kind of spotlight a little harder on how it's a retrofit. And then somehow that makes it all the bit better.
Yeah. Only time will tell if this was a good decision or not. But
yes,
obviously, someone who was going to be on an old Emirates 777 will be very happy with this upgrade. I love that we managed to have that whole discussion without bringing up Etihad a single time.
I think by not bringing up Etihad, we've done all the talking about it. it's like the most appropriate thing, because I think that just kind of shows how they've slipped into just not even being a true competitor to Emirates. I mean, years ago, we would have been having that discussion. It would have been Emirates versus Etihad, and as if the two were, trying to outdo each other from an hour away from each other's respective hubs between Dubai and Abu Dhabi. As you just said, we just had a full debate. They didn't even come up once. We were yeah, speaking more. I mean, Gulf Air made an appearance.
Okay, that's bad. I love how I was like, I can book you on Qatar Airways, Gulf Air, as if for someone living in Dubai, Etihad is not the second most logical option.
Well, that says more about Etihad's position in the aviation market than anything else. So.
Yeah, but they do have the best airport now in the Middle East, I think, if not one of the best in the world. So, yay, Etihad.
I don't know about the world. I think that's a bit of a stretch, but definitely for the Middle East. Speaking and quickly sticking with the Middle East for now, in a slightly more serious topic, of course, there are tensions across the region, as there have been for some time. Once again, kind of the escalations that are being threatened by the likes of Iran and, of course, Israel, and everything in relation to Beirut in Lebanon, we have seen aviation once again vulnerable to geopolitical conflict. We've spoken extensively before about how aviation is inherently exposed to just about everything, but not least, some brewing tensions, especially those that are in the Middle East. This is not anything new, but with the recent developments and the arguably, the escalations to the entire conflict as a whole in terms of those sub-developments, such as the assassination or alleged assassination of one of the political leaders of Hamas while he was in Iran, with Iran threatening to now advance or make some kind of advancement to or into Israel. Aviation has had no choice but to respond to all of this in order to ensure the safety of you and us, the public, the passengers, and of course, crew. And so I guess the most significant developments that we've seen so far are is the mass exodus of carriers in Lebanon, because it is widely believed that something is going to happen in Lebanon. And therefore, we've seen a whole bunch of European carriers, everyone from Aegean of Greece to the Lufthansa Group, which includes, of course, Swiss, but also British Airways, and so many other carriers, stop and suspend their flights to Beirut, as well as some other neighboring countries. There are some airlines that are also suspending flights to Amman in Jordan because they feel that it's simply too close and there is a lot of uncertainty as to what's going on. And there are questions as to what is going to happen over the next week and what the further impact will be on aviation if we have an escalated conflict involving the likes of Iran and Israel and Beirut, and Lebanon, and so on and so on. And that's obviously deeply concerning for passengers who are transiting through, for the region itself, but also as airlines try to figure out how they navigate this, right?
Yeah. So once again, like we saw a few months ago, we now have most Western airlines and Asian airlines avoiding Iraqi and Iranian airspace. So many are rerouting via Saudi airspace, which I remember you laughing last time because I said, I feel so safe in Saudi airspace, but I guess relatively I
no,
do.
That's fine. No, that's, I would feel complete. I do feel completely safe in Saudi airspace. Yeah. There's no question of their safety.
Yeah, exactly. So we have, you know, Air France KLM, Lufthansa Group, Finnair, all of these airlines, for example, choosing to reroute their flights via Saudi airspace, which is adding flight time to some routes. Then we have, of course, the Middle Eastern airlines are continuing to fly over Iraq and Iran because this is such essential airspace for them. So the question here is, what happens if the conflict escalates and suddenly, let's say, Iranian airspace is no longer available? Because that would be that would have a huge impact for Middle Eastern airlines flying to the US, flying to parts of Europe. I know that Emirates has now switched to use Iranian and Russian airspace to fly from Dubai to Stockholm, for example, which is a big switch because they used to go, you know, through Europe and past Ukraine. And also, I'd love, you know, connected to that, we're seeing Middle Eastern airlines continue to fly to Iran and Iraq, but retiming their flights to only operate during daylight.
And that's quite key here, because we've noticed, or at least, you know, the security agencies that work with airlines and that airlines rely on their intel know that most of these escalations occur during the hours of darkness, right? And we had this, of course, just a few months ago, where at one point Iraqi airspace was closed because of overflying missiles that were making their way from one side to the other. And Iranian airspace at one point, or part of Iran's airspace, was shut, leaving a big question mark as to whether or not Egypt would follow, because if Egypt followed, a whole load of the Gulf would be trapped and unable to get out. And so the way in which they mitigate and try to plan for, you know, in an uncertain time is by, as you say, introducing those measures that we saw a number of airlines do, which is to forbid the ordinary scheduled flights that would typically depart at 1 a.m. to the likes of Iraq and Iran and so on, to forbid the operation in the hours of darkness, knowing that it is in the hours of darkness that an escalation is more likely. And I don't know about you, but you know that I am fully subscribed up to all of these kind of different intelligence agencies and knowing about what is brewing and where and what is happening.
Well, you have some intel from the CIA that I don't know.
No. I don't mean intelligence agencies like state federal intelligence agencies. I mean intelligent agencies that provide you with constant risk assessments, right? So it's a constant risk assessments, and also on with providing you with intel on what's happening, right? And every night the evening begins with a kind of "is it tonight" question, and a whole load of evidence is gathered to kind of pinpoint whether it looks more likely that an escalation is going to be tonight or not. And this is what airlines are also working on. So it's a, you know, it's a difficult time anyway, on a human level, of course. But speaking operationally in terms of as an airline, it's a difficult time to be constantly navigating and trying to assess what is the right decision to take. Interestingly, Amman, Jordan, of course, Jordan is incredibly popular for tourism and for tourists, and they have some incredible sites and UNESCO heritage sites and so on dotted around the country. There is so much to see and do in Jordan, not just, of course, the city Amman, but outside in the likes
especially
of Petra. Especially
outside the city.
Yeah, exactly. Especially. In fact, Amman, you can do in a day and it's done. Yeah. Amman is requiring every operator flying to Amman to operate with an additional 45 minutes worth of fuel. Now, many airlines will already be flying with a reserve amount of fuel. Well, no, all airlines are flying with reserve fuel, but many airlines will be flying with reserve that is equivalent to 45 minutes because these are part of standard operating procedures in case an aircraft needs to divert or so. But what's interesting is that we're having this actually mandated as a civil aviation requirement from the likes of Jordan because they know that at a moment's notice, they might have to pull the plug on airspace and say, we're closed because it's happening. You know, the escalation that everyone is fearing is happening. And therefore, they would have to turn back aircraft
to
at
Cairo,
short notice.
Probably, or something.
Well, the interesting part is, of course, where do they then divert? That's why they need extra 45 minutes, because perhaps in other countries where there could be geopolitical issues, the neighboring country might not be problematic and therefore safe to land. This is not the case here in this part of the East Mediterranean and this side of the Middle East. And therefore, airlines need to be prepared for those last-minute fluctuations and changes.
Yeah, I would guess they would divert to Cyprus or Cairo, depending on the flight and the airline. And Royal Jordanian is using Israeli airspace. So for them, you know, for example, Cyprus is a very short flight away. So
it always fascinates me how Cyprus sits so strategically within this, you know, this region where so much is going on, you know, especially this East Mediterranean region. It's like little Cyprus, where one of my parents is from, kind of sitting there floating as a little holiday island, just in the middle of all this absolute geopolitical turmoil. And it's like, yeah, you know, come for the souvlaki.
Yeah,
everything's
we
chill.
We have nice beaches. Just come chill. It is interesting. I think I also want to bring up like British Airways as an interesting example here, because in contrast to many other European airlines, British Airways, which is known to be one of the safest, most reliable airlines in the world, was one of the first airlines to start using Afghan airspace again. They are still using Iraqi airspace. So they obviously use some different intelligence or metrics to decide where it's safe to fly or not. But since they started using Afghan airspace, then I flew in it on Finnair in, when was it, the end of April, which was also one of the first airlines. Now you have all types of airlines using Afghan airspace. You have multiple European airlines. You have Singapore Airlines flying through as we speak on an A380 through Afghan airspace. So, you know, we kind of have this tunnel to Asia that's been created over Georgia and Afghanistan past Turkey and then Turkmenistan and then going either north, sort of up over more stands, or south over Afghanistan. And if we see conflict arise in the Middle East, meaning airlines don't want to use Iraqi airspace, I think Afghan airspace will suddenly become a really, really valuable asset to many airlines to be able to continue operating routes that are really at risk at the moment.
I've just received a comment on the which is, again, I know we've been discussing this at length, but this is quite interesting. This kind of backs up your point, one of your points that you were making. Just to quickly go back to the Emirates discussion, he says,
oh, not again.
The main difference is that Etihad and Qatar have relatively few first class seats. Emirates has a lot, more than anyone. Cannibalizing first class is a real risk for Emirates and not for the others. This was never going to be a revolutionary seat from Emirates. And no, these are not repurposed about the seats. That's interesting.
Yeah.
It's a valid
good
point
I made.
About first. It is a good point. Yes, yes. Well, SA Cricket Lover _ agrees with you.
That's my backup account. No, I'm kidding.
I knew it. That's just Oscar in the back, isn't it? Oscar's thinking, yeah. I'm not having Dan being roasted early, this early on a Wednesday morning.
Okay, so what else do we have to talk about that's more... Do we have any positive news? I know you had an interesting story about airline CEOs.
Well, yeah, it's the habits that different... So, you know, we always hear in those kind of... whether people are promoting a book or they're being interviewed on TV about the successful habits of a CEO, right? And it's usually involves something like meditating at 4:12 in the morning, or, you know, doing a headstand in between every meeting and so on, right? Well, I think it's not so often that we get the insight as to how airline CEOs structure their day or work, because I would argue it's an entirely different ballgame as to, for example, running a multinational company from an office, and you are, you know, stabilizing and ensuring the smooth running of XYZ. Whereas, as we have spoken about at length, aviation is so inherently exposed to everything. You know, an inoperable water tap on an A380 is enough to send one back to Sydney and ground 503 passengers and put them in hotels and so on. You've got a whole kind of international matter at hand there. That I think being at the top of an airline, your habits would be different to that of being at the top of, for example, a consultancy company, or a, you know, a Deloitte, let's say.
Yeah.
Right? So the CEO of IAG had done an interview with the FT. And in this interview...
I love how you're just saying all these acronyms. IAG, FT.
Sorry. Yes. Okay, sorry. Did I say FT? Right. Okay. Yeah. The CEO of the International Airlines Group, they are the parent company owner of British Airways, Iberia, Vueling, Level, Aer Lingus. Better?
Yes, much better. Now continue.
His name is Luis Galero. And he was interviewed with the FT, also known as the Financial Times. And in this interview, he's discussing about how ultimately he's trying to drive change in the face of resistance. And he's trying to, you know, the fact that he's got Iberia so profitable is great for him, but he's had to endure years of crisis management since 2020 and everything that British Airways has had to kind of struggle, and also the way that they associate BA with British culture, and he's trying to amplify that, and how they've been plagued by IT outages and strikes and so on and so on. But a part of the interview that I quite liked was a day in the life of Luis. Okay, so if you were the CEO of IAG, what time would you wake up in the morning? I mean, no, you know the job, right? No, you know the scope. Okay, yeah. So I just find these little details interesting, because if, you know, that's a unique airline CEO position. British Airways, Iberia, Aer Lingus, Vueling, and Level, all under you. What time are you waking up?
Well, it depends when I need to get to the office, I guess.
Well, you decide when you arrive to the office, no?
Oh, okay, I might get up at 6:30.
Okay, that's the same time Luis gets up. So apparently you have more in common with the CEO than... Yeah. So he says he gets up. What's the first thing he does? Now, this is interesting, because in all of the self-help CEO books, this is what they all say the first thing of what not to do. Okay, so he says the first thing he does is check his emails.
Yeah.
Right? And he says that also he's very conscious that... He said, some of our airlines are already an hour ahead in Spain. Okay, Luis, most of them, right? I mean, Iberia, Vueling, Level, you know, is that kind of like taking up most of the group there. But
yeah.
So it's interesting that, okay, so he's checking his emails first thing. Rest of the CEOs that are outside the airline industry are saying, don't check your emails before, you know, 8 a.m. or 9 a.m. or whatever. Then he says he arrives to the head office at 8:30 in the morning. And the IAG shares the office with British Airways, which of course we know. And he says, depending on the day, he'll be planning for a weekly deep dive session with one of our businesses, or having meetings with team members, or attending a management meeting, and so on and so on. He then says that at lunch, he doesn't actually take a proper lunch. It's just, quote, a working one accompanied by an email inbox check, squeezed in around meetings, and that the desk is in the center of an open plan floor for people to be able to approach him without having to knock on the door. Quite nice. And then in the evening, he says, if Real Madrid are playing, he tries to rush home. But his real passion, of course, is his family. And he says he has two teenage children, which he tries to find the time to catch up with them and ask how their day was. He admits that because he's traveling so much for work, these conversations are the ones that he must make the most time for. And so that kind of interview, that kind of brief part there, got me thinking about what we hear about how, you know, if at the top of the airline, how you would structure your day to ensure that there is that balance. But also, would it not be so easy to just be absorbed into a mammoth 24/7 operation that I think I myself would find it pretty hard to be able to switch off even a little bit?
Yeah, but that's what I admire, that he maybe isn't connected to work 24/7, because I feel like toxic productivity and like a lot of cultures encourage just working, forget your family, don't, you know.
Yeah, that's bad.
And that's so bad. It's so bad. So I think I'm happy to hear whenever someone isn't just work. And when it's like, not like, I get up at 4 a.m., I run on the treadmill for 2 hours as I'm reading and doing finger exercises. And then, like, that's what so many people say. And it's just like, this is so unrealistic. And
it is.
You're going to get burned out immediately. So
given that IAG, of course, owned British Airways, I thought, okay, let's take a look at how Richard Branson starts his day. Okay, so Richard Branson, of course, the founder of Virgin Atlantic, he says, quote, getting up early gives me time to get on top of things and chart my day effectively. Okay, he then says that the reason he likes to wake up early is so that he can work through his emails before most of the world even logs on. Living in the British Virgin Islands, he likes to be online early so that he's accessible and available to all of the office time, to all of the offices in other time zones. So he says he wakes up at 5 a.m. So he's got a 90-minute head start before Luis is even up, right? And then, but arguably, he's not the CEO anymore. So anyway, he still says he wakes up at 5 a.m. Then he takes a very early morning ice bath, right? So
yeah.
He then goes to play a hard game of singles tennis around 6:15 in the morning. After
that
finishing tennis, he's on to his next sport, if the weather permits, kite surfing. And of course, there was that famous photo
is
where he was kite surfing with Barack Obama. This is what he says every day. He then stops for breakfast, which includes at least one cup of tea. He says, to keep me energized, I drink lots of tea. I'm talking 20 cups a day. Don't tell my doctor. Also, his go-to is a decaf English breakfast, and he has been feeling great ever since cutting out caffeine. So that's just a recap. Awake at 5, ice bath, tennis, kite surfing, tea, right?
I don't believe
After breakfast, this is what he's written. After breakfast, he says he takes a walk, a long walk, on the 74-acre private island where he lives. And just for context, Richard Branson bought Necker Island, which is in the British Virgin Islands, in the late 70s. He bought it for only $180,000. So that was a steal.
Wow.
During his walk, his assistant reads his emails to him. Now, I don't know how I feel about that. He'll also sit down with his assistant at other times throughout the day to reply to anything else that comes in. So this is that verbal email exchange that I've seen some other older airline CEOs engage in, where they don't actually, they're not emailing themselves, but rather they're hearing the email read out to them and responding yeah. verbally. I don't like that. That's a little bit, that's it. It then says, after his walk, Branson admits to then spending the next 20 or so minutes working out.
I mean, what?
Yeah. He then spends some time socializing with the guests on the island before finally doing some work, and then it's time for lunch. At night, Branson admits he'll go cycling again or head back to the tennis courts. He said he likes to go for 2 extreme bike rides a week and also enjoys a good game of chess before bed. He then likes to finish the day with a group dinner. Okay, that's very nice, where stories are shared and ideas are born, blah, blah, blah. And his traditional foods are British. He likes shepherd's pie, British roast, and all this kind of thing. Before turning in for the night, finally, at around 11 p.m, he says, I need 6 hours of sleep to then do it all over again. And that is a day in the life of Richard Branson, which I can't, admittedly, no longer running Virgin Atlantic, so not having to worry too much about the operational side of things. But, I mean, do we buy that?
I don't. Richard Branson is, I mean, he's one of your biggest inspirations. He's an inspiration for a lot of people. And I think people who have those roles or who write those types of books to inspire people tend to exaggerate or try to share a very inspirational version of their life. But that's just, yeah, that's maybe on a perfect day. That's what his day is like. What do you think?
Perhaps. No, I agree with you. I just think it seems a little unrealistic. I mean, I'm not sure at what part of the day he sold most of the airline to Delta and then got rid of the bars and replaced them with the lounge and, you know, and cost cut everything in premium economy. So my neighbor, Rob, he just flew to LA and back with Virgin Atlantic. The last time he flew Virgin was several years ago, and he flew premium on the A350-1000 from Heathrow to Los Angeles. And he was there for 3 weeks, then he came back. And he was really surprised at the cost cutting that has happened ever since his last Virgin Atlantic experience. He said to me, he described to me, it's the little things that he loved. And he said to me, it's the little things that are no longer there.
Like?
Ice cream. No, they have ice cream.
Oh, okay.
Other little bits. You know, for example, the amenity kit.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember.
They don't
that.
Have an amenity kit because it's a daytime flight. But come on, it's like 11 hours.
And it doesn't cost that much.
It doesn't cost anything. Okay, when they're ordering in bulk, it doesn't cost anything. he said all the other little bits that they used, he just used to remember being like the flair and spice of Virgin Atlantic, and it was just missing.
Yeah, that's such a shame. Let's go back to the beginning. Let's go all the way back to the beginning of the episode, because the coconut tree has delivered a good idea, hasn't it?
Yes, well, if you're referring to Kamala Harris, Vice President, we have some news about how a Kamala Harris presidency might impact global aviation, ladies and gents, because, well, she has a little idea as to what she calls a grievance on board when you're flying. She has an opinion on those that are flying that have removed their shoes and then perhaps even removed, God forbid, their socks. And, well, here's what Kamala had to say.
Had it or hit it, people taking their shoes off on airplanes.
Oh, God, had it completely. It's terrible. Awful. And then if they take their shoes off and then cross their legs so that their foot is just dangling right in front of
the
you.
Aisle.
It's just, and especially if they're sockless.
The sockless people in an airport. It's unbelievable.
Mm-mm. So let me tell you what happened to me.
Okay.
I'm on an international flight, asleep.
Uh-huh.
And I hear this.
Oh, I know what you're going to say.
Wakes me up.
Yeah.
I get up. The woman behind me is in like a full lotus with her foot right up here. And she is clipping her toenails.
Oh, God.
I'm rather alarmed. And I'm looking around to see, does she have a collection place where she's collecting these toenails?
They're flying all over the place.
They're just on the plane.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, you might have the FAA look into that.
We'll look into that, too. Yeah, we'll look into that,
these are the issues that could bring out some
niche
voters.
We need a Department of Grievances.
We could run it.
We have a lot of federal agencies, but not that one.
We'll be the secretaries.
Exactly.
Wow, this is a niche issue that will bring out some voters. And you know what I love is that these are the important questions, okay? We need to stop caring about what people do at their doctor's office, because that's, as we now say, weird. And we need to start caring about things that everyone cares about, like people clipping their toenails on planes. This is
awful.
Serious.
I mean, but what I like is that, okay, I mean, she's proposing policy there. She's proposing a specialized agency, the Department of Grievances, where she is saying that she will address everything that is horrible about air travel and ultimately try to do something about it. Should we see if we can get you a job there, Dan?
I think you should get a job there. If anything, you'd make like Clorox wipes mandatory before sitting down. On
Damn right. Look, if I come, Madam Vice President, if I can take the position remotely, I'm in.
I'll take it on the spot. I don't care. I would love to contribute that. But I think Pete, Transport Secretary Pete, is doing a good job with what he can in terms of improving the industry.
Yeah, my friend Pete Buttigieg, who's a good friend of mine, he is doing a good job. You're right.
Pete, text me sometime.
Sound desperate, okay. Dan. Let's go to Q&A. Anyway. Okay, I've got a question here from Skander. The question is, hi, Alex and Dan. I love the podcast that you do. Your podcast is the only thing that makes me sit through Wednesdays. I had a situation-based question for you. On a recent 13-hour flight from Abu Dhabi to Boston, I was stuck in a middle seat on the Dreamliner's middle section. I figured that it wouldn't be that bad because Etihad has quite a nice product. Anyway, during the flight, the man next to me kept elbowing me and putting his legs underneath the seat in front of me. I tried to tell him to stop, but he didn't understand what I was saying, and it was kind of hard to wake him up. I got fed up when he elbowed my face and pushed it away from my own headrest. He probably thought that a 14-year-old doesn't need the space that the seat provided. The forward section of economy was full as well, limiting my options for moving seats. What would you do? God, that's horrible. I would try to sit anywhere else.
So yeah. It's Etihad.
Yeah.
Which means it's not a U.S. airline, which means you won't get arrested for saying a single thing to the cabin crew. So I would probably talk to the crew and see, is there anywhere else, possibly anywhere else on this entire plane I could sit? Or can you tell this man to behave so that I don't have to tell him to behave and then have a negative interaction for the rest of the flight?
Yeah.
What would you do?
Yep, I think that's sound advice. I think I would do exactly the same. Yeah.
Yeah. On a U.S. airline, I would probably just shut up because the crew will not help you.
Next question here is from Sylvia. She says, Alex, I fly Qantas often, and as an expat doing Australia to LA and then Mexico with American or Aeromexico, this new A350 cabin, so these are the photos that I put, will be a massive flop, as was their attempt of the A380 lounge area. The old and revamped versions that are currently exist are very rarely used. So Sylvia's mentioning this about, you know, the wellness space on Qantas A350s that are coming up, yeah, whereby you're supposedly going to be able to stretch, hang out with other passengers, do a bit of yoga. There's some really mixed opinions as to whether or not this area is going to be a success or not. She says, by the way, I love the podcast. Missed it on Thursday, but can't wait for the next episode. What do you think about that area, the well-being zone on Qantas's upcoming A350s? This is an area that it ordinarily would house a galley. It's not going to have a galley. It's going to be this social space. There is no bar. There is no counter to lean on. There are no obvious seats as per the rendering, but rather it's a space. It's a space that they want you to, you know, space out and kind of do the spatial related spacey things. And the reason I say it in that way is because they haven't actually pinpointed the purpose for this. What do you think?
I think we know the purpose of this, but we can announce to the world that airlines like, if they make this type of space, unless it's on the A380, it's to reduce weight and be able to fly further. So I think that's what Qantas is up to here. They found, you know, it's around the doors, so they could just add a little more space there, reduce the weight a bit, and make everyone happy and market it as something nice.
A few replies to that. People were saying, Mick says, agreed, not sure that a yoga video being played on loop is going to do the trick. And other passengers were saying that they felt that there just wasn't a clear enough purpose for it to just not be, for example, a place where passengers just kind of group around and congregate and stand and talk, which of course is against US law on flights to the US. You're not allowed to be gathered in groups ever since 9/11. So how's that going to work?
That's so true.
Let's see.
On flights to the US, you're not allowed. Okay, first question I have is from Christina. She says, hi, Dan. On your last podcast, you talked about how common bus gates are around the world and not in the US. Just curious how those with mobility issues are accommodated in that situation. Love the podcast. I never thought I would be so committed to listening to an aviation podcast, but here we are.
Aww. We love that. We love that.
Love that. So, Alex, do you want to explain or should I?
I think you go for it first.
So my grandma just got to do this when she flew from Gothenburg on Ryanair. Ryanair actually does use gates in Gothenburg, but even then, sometimes for people who can't step over something, it works the same as with a bus gate. And basically what you do then is that you have an accessibility bus where you can roll someone in on a wheelchair. It almost looks like a catering vehicle. And then it pulls up in the usually in the rear door of an aircraft and loads people off. So you basically get your own little shuttle to the plane. Sometimes companions get to go along. So I know my mom got to do it with my grandma one time. And I'm like, oh my gosh, I wish that was me, because I would love to see what that experience is like to get more insight into how that works. But yeah, it basically just looks like a big catering truck that delivers people onto the plane and no steps or anything are required.
And that's, of course, you know, I like to see that the strides aviation continues to make in becoming more accessible, especially in premium cabins as well, but also in economy class cabins, whereby, you know, everyone should have peace of mind as to how they are going to approach the travel day, right? And I think it's always important to be mindful of that. And also, of course, the whole bunch of, you know, for example, hidden disabilities that are not obvious that people need to be mindful of as well. And I think that can be really challenging in different cultures and countries where hidden disabilities are not as commonly either understood or noticed, or there's kind of that lack of awareness. And I would hate to think that that will put off anyone from taking the trip that they want to trip or being apprehensive or nervous about it. The good thing is as Dan highlighted, there are all kind of not just policies, but practical measures that are in place to ensure that aviation can be as smooth for anyone of any ability, regardless of age or abilities and so on and so on.
Yeah, and I think that's a good point about seats as well, that at least looking at this Emirates seat, it looks very accessible, especially the aisle seat, because I think what you miss in a lot of seats with doors nowadays, and also on narrow aircraft like an A330, for example, it can be very tight for someone who has mobility issues or is obese. So, you know, at least here there's space. I remember when I flew Q Suite about a month ago, I don't know how much I can't remember how much I spoke on that about that flight on the podcast, but the women in the row next to me, there were two women who must have weighed at least 150 kilo and they could barely close the door because they were so wide, but at least they were sitting in business and not in economy, so they had the space to do that. They weren't bothering anyone else, but it was quite it's something I've honestly never seen before.
The next question I have quickly here is from Sean. It's kind of linked with the Qantas question. So we've answered the first part, but I want to get your thoughts on the second part. He says, "Hi, Alex, love your work on the podcast. Question for both yourself and Dan. I'm interested to get your thoughts on the upcoming Qantas Sunrise, Project Sunrise, the non-stop Sydney to London and Sydney to New York flights, and I'm looking forward to Qantas receiving the first A350-1000s. So I'm curious to know how they plan on configuring the cabin for ultra-long-haul flights. I believe they intend on having the well-being facility area and different design seating, so we've just spoken about that. But he also says, I have a feeling that the cost to fly these routes will be ultra expensive. Do you think that Project Sunrise, these non-stop flights between Sydney and London, will be successful? And will you be up for taking the 20-plus hour marathon journey? Thanks so much, Sean from Melbourne." I think that there are just as many people, Sean, that are willing to go non-stop and fly 20 hours as there are that are willing to take one stop and fly, for example, you know, 14 hours in one hit, followed by an additional seven. And so I think that the market is definitely there. The market is definitely there for premium and business travel. That's for sure. And I do think that in the right way, just like how Perth-London flights are widely regarded as successful currently, I think that Sydney to London to, you know, a bit more of a prominent route compared with Perth, I think that it will be a success eventually, measured as a success. And as I say, I think there is a market, just as many people that want to just go the whole way there in one hit as there are that want to stop. Would I personally be willing to do the 20 plus hour journey nonstop between Sydney and London? Absolutely.
I love how you had so much doubt in your voice and then absolutely. I would love to do it too. But yeah, the prices will be crazy. It's interesting if you look at Singapore Airlines, New York to Singapore though, because business is very expensive, but there are often pretty good deals in premium economy. Like sometimes you can fly round trip for $900, I think, in premium economy for the world's longest flight, which is crazy low when you consider it's almost 40 hours of flying. So different cabins will be successful to different degrees, but I certainly think business and first will be some of the most expensive flights we've ever seen, and they will probably manage to fill them, specifically since they're flying to places like London and New York, which have, you know, among the highest yield traffic in the world. I have a question here from Nisa, or not so much a question, but she says, I hope you shared this on your podcast. I hope it might be a good tip for others wanting to get a free upgrade. So she says, I want to tell a fun story of how I got upgraded to business class on Turkish Airlines. I've never flown business class in my life, but it was always a dream of mine. I knew with Turkish Airlines that you can get an upgrade if you pay an extra fee depending on your flight. However, I thought it was a bit too expensive for me, so I wanted to see if I could get a free upgrade if I asked during check-in at the airport. So I did, but the lady said it was not possible, but she would keep it in mind. I didn't know what she meant by that initially. When we were finally boarding, I scanned my boarding pass, but they told me I had to go to the desk where workers were and the same lady. I was a bit confused, and she eventually said to me, I have a surprise for you. She apparently upgraded me to business class. I couldn't believe it because she first told me it was impossible, but it really made my day. So I'm really glad to hear that Nisa had that success. What do you make of this situation, and what might have been the reason that she actually...
I was listening to you read, and I was like, what? That's... I don't know. How can we explain that? Firstly, fantastic news. Genuinely happy for you. It's such an exciting moment when that happens. I don't know how it happened or why. Yeah. I don't know.
My own... So if this wasn't just some extreme luck, my only suspicion would be that economy was overbooked. There weren't many people with Turkish status. And then she... Maybe the lady was a manager or something that she checked in with, and she had the discretion to be like, okay, this lady asked me kindly, so out of all the people, we can upgrade her. That's the only explanation. But I guess the moral of that might be, hey, it doesn't hurt to ask for an upgrade. At the same time, I don't really believe in like pestering staff who get those requests constantly by also saying, hey, what about a free upgrade? So
Forget, airlines have to upgrade passengers all the time for operational reasons, not least, as Dan just highlighted, that economy is oversold. And I can remember two examples. First example, it was, I think it was Ramadan. Okay, so that's typically a month where, for example, let's look at the Gulf. You won't have outbound leisure travel from the Gulf at that time. Okay, so where now, for example, in the middle of summer, if you go to a city like London or Paris, there are many, many, many Gulf tourists and, you know, visitors from the Gulf region, the Middle East. That won't be the case in those periods because people are with their families and at home and observing the holy month and so on. So reason I'm telling you this is I was flying from London to Muscat in Oman with Oman Air, and there were zero Omanis on board that flight, which is unusual because on any given day, a lot of the, especially up front, will be occupied by Omanis or perhaps Saudis and so on. So there were basically no Khalijis, which is Gulf Arabs, on board in the cabin, which also meant that there were virtually no frequent flyers, because if you're an Oman Air frequent flyer, it's very likely that you are going to be living in Oman, either Omani or living there, or perhaps from a neighboring country like Saudi Arabia. So they had barely any frequent flyers on board, and they had none of their regulars, and the flight was still oversold in economy because it had fallen with one of the UK holidays, kind of like school holidays. So they're in a situation where, and I was overhearing this prior to me checking in, that they needed to upgrade something crazy like 12 passengers from economy into business class. And Oman Air has a beautiful business class product, right? Especially then when this flight was. So as I'm queuing to check in, I'm hearing this kind of team meeting going ahead, and they are the third party ground handling agent for Oman Air at the time. And the team leader says to her team, right, anyone who is nice to you, smiles, looks decent, is okay, she's explaining like this, and has a nice interaction for you, with you, don't allocate them their seat in economy, upgrade them into business. And I remember thinking, it's true. You know, people hear this, you know, should they dress a certain way or whatever? So, and then the team went, yep, okay. Now, luckily on that flight, I was already flying business, but had I not been, I would have made sure that I was super, oh no, the truth be told, I would have left the queue immediately, gone to one of the many WH Smith or something, bought a £15 box of Lindor Lindt chocolate, you know, the nice ones that I like, right? And rocked up to the desk and, good morning, I just bought you this because you guys do such a difficult job, you know, checking people in. You guys do it so well. And I think I will have landed the upgrade, because what's funny is, as I say, when I looked around once I finally boarded and I was already confirmed in biz, when I looked around, most of the passengers were kind of, you know, bright-eyed, looking around at this cabin and amazed by the pre-departure champagne and so on. And it was really nice, but I just thought, wow, okay, this is a reminder that actually, for operational reasons, it does happen. So, guys, please be nice all the time and be kind to one another. But especially if this motivates you, it's just another reason to not be an asshole when you travel.
I love that. It made me think that what if there was like a lottery, some kind of thing that if there's ever empty seats, the people were very aware that the person who has been nicest to the staff could get the upgrade. So it's like an incentive that everyone knows about. If you're really nice to them, you'll have the highest odds of an upgrade. And it will, maybe it will never happen, but then you've done something good as well. Because the flying public, we've spoken about it so much, you know, people get airplane brain or airport brain or whatever we call it, and just behave really rudely. How lovely would it be to have some incentive from the airline side for people to be pleasant?
Definitely. And just before we wrap up, a couple of quick headlines that I want to just get out to you as loyal listeners, because we've discussed it so much and I want to update you on since we last spoke. One, the European Commission is bringing back rules on liquids. Did you see this? Even though we've got the new scanners everywhere.
What?
Yes. Wait, so they are saying that the new scanners are ultimately inaccurate and are failing on too many occasions. And so any airports that lifted the restrictions across Europe on liquids, those rules are back at the end of this month.
Interesting. I wonder if it's because of the heightened terror threats all across Europe.
They say that it's not. I wondered that as well. They say it's not in relation to any specific threat or any general threat in terms of us being in a period of conflict and what's happening in the Middle East. But they say it's to do with the reliability of the scanners, which is kind of a shame, of course.
Yeah, really a shame. As long as we don't have to start taking everything out of the laptops. Bag again.
It's the tech that is the issue, you know?
Yeah, like as long as we can keep our under 100 ml liquids and everything in the bag, I'm still really happy with the new scanners because that makes such a big difference.
As far as I know, it will be the case that you are able to leave the liquids inside of the bags. I'm just getting confirmation on this now. That's why I'm kind of stalling. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So you can leave the liquids in the bag. Yeah. But those previous 100 mil limitations apply.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
So that's that. Yeah. Southwest Airlines are going to ditch open seating and bring allocated seating. That's kind of a shockwave in America. We'll dive into that a bit more next week. And British Airways are bringing back duty-free on board some of their routes. When was the last time you bought anything on a flight, on a long-haul flight, not a short-haul flight, but a long-haul flight? I certainly don't remember.
I buy souvenir, like airplane knickknacks, like airline souvenirs, those types of things, once or twice a year in duty free.
No, but that's duty free. But what about on board?
No. Like on board, if they have, let's say,
who has it?
Like Emirates or Lufthansa have both had tags made from metal on their A380 or A340 respectively.
And that's selling them on the aircraft?
Yeah, only on board, like on board exclusives. Okay. Then I think it makes sense to sell lightweight airline souvenirs, like those weigh almost nothing. But to have like whiskey and cigarettes and stuff.
So weird. Yeah.
That makes me wonder who is buying this. But it's a big thing in some parts of the world. So
it is. It is. Well, we'll dive a little more into that next week. Guys, thank you for joining us on air with Dan and Alex on this early Wednesday morning in August. We have loved our discussion, no doubt. I mean, I have.
I have too. I love a healthy debate.
Yeah.
And also, we're approaching 1 year, I just realized, of on air in a few weeks. I cannot believe that.
Time is flying by. Time flies when you're having fun, and we're certainly having fun on the podcast. We're also excited to take you through some updates, some new features that might be coming up really soon. More on that in next week's episode. But from myself, and I trust also from Dan, we'll see you next week.
From me too. See you next week on air. Bye-bye.
Fall's here, and so are incredible sales at Tanger Outlets. Find must-have handbags, footwear, and all the latest fall arrivals, all at unbeatable savings. Shop top brands like Nike Factory, Crocs, J. Crew Factory, Coach, Gap Factory, Old Navy Outlet, Under Armour, and even more brands you love. Save more every time you shop with deals up to 70% off. Tanger Outlets, always on trend, always on sale. Plan your trip at tanger.com.
How do people feel about getting Big Fitness Energy at Planet Fitness for $15 a month?
They feel as thrilled as a kid the first summer they're tall enough to ride the roller coaster. That's right. When you join Planet Fitness right now, you get access to tons of equipment and free fitness training in a clean and spacious club. Don't wait. Join the judgment-free zone today for that all-day energy. Download the free Planet Fitness app and join today for $15 a month.
Hurry. Deal ends September 12th. Join today for $15 a month.
See Home Club for details.